I'm Divya Shekhar, and this is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. Our guest on today's episode calls herself a defiant optimist. Now, defiance and optimism are two words you would never really think about putting together. In the same way, like you would never really think about taking on traditional financial systems and making it work for the 99% people instead of the 1% wealthy. But that's exactly what Doreen Shehnaz went about doing in her life. She had the stubborn belief that systems that enrich a few can be transformed for the good of the many. In her own words, this is how she explains what a defiant optimist is, which is also the title of her new book.
So the word itself, defiant, is actually something that is, yes, it's going against the status quo, but it also has a lot of courage, I would say, in that word, right? And in terms of optimism, it's really sort of saying the optimism is more real when you know that you're doing something that is beyond just for yourself. It is really your North Star, in a way, to really make the world more inclusive.
So listeners, that was the voice of Doreen Shehnaz, who's the founder of Singapore's Impact Investment Exchange. More on that later. Welcome to From the Bookshelves, Doreen.
So first and foremost, Divya, thank you very much for arranging this. And I'm really, really happy to be having this chat. And I'm also really thrilled to have an audience in India and in South Asia, to be listening to this and exploring the book, because so much of our work is there. So much of my life has been shaped by India. And of course, I'm originally from Bangladesh. And this is all kind of doing all this for home. Let's put it that way. So I'm very, very happy about this.
I'm just going to give a short bio of Doreen Shehnaz for our listeners out there. So Doreen was the first Bangladeshi woman to work on Wall Street when she joined Morgan Stanley in 1989. She then left a lucrative job in the US to work with Grameen on microfinance in rural Bangladesh. And later, a couple of years later, launched her own online marketplace, One Nest, to connect artisans and their handcrafted products with buyers. Then finally, she launched one of the world's first stock exchanges for social enterprises, the Impact Investment Exchange out of Singapore. She's had a really, really long career. And Doreen, what I want to ask you is that in all these years, have you managed to find a perfect answer for how to make financial markets work for social good? Because even today, I feel, companies and investors worldwide still perhaps value profit over purpose.
Well, I think I definitely have. And that's why I could write the book. Because if I didn't, I wouldn't have written the book. Because the reality is, the book actually covers sort of the journey in terms of, what it took me to get there, in order to kind of make that linkage between, creating social good, environmental good, equity, it's a big one, it's sort of the societal equity and justice, and bringing all that into the financial markets. And how do you actually measure the social impact and be able to correlate that, with the financial return, the financial market? So my answer is a resounding yes, that we have been able to do that. We have been able to get investors to actually equate, I would say, profit with purpose. And the reality is, for us, we have now put out over $300 million in the market, one third of that actually in India. And so close to $100 million in India we have put in, we have invested in India. And we haven't had a single cent, single rupee of default. And I think the reason is because of the fact that we make very, very deep impact with our work, and we have been able to show, we quantified it, that how if you create deep impact, that means the risk of the investment actually goes down. And that's why our investments have given such fantastic results, both as social return as well as financial return. So yes.
Right. So could you talk a little more about your experience on Wall Street? And you were there for 2 years working with Morgan Stanley before you started working with Grameen. How did that experience hold you in good stead? Were there any learnings or lessons from Wall Street that still help you with IIX as well?
Sure. I think one of the biggest learnings for me, in Wall Street was the fact that the reality is, the financial system is there. It is about people making money. So let's not kind of fool ourselves. Okay, so you can't be thinking of a system and calling it something along the lines of a financial system that's actually not making money for the investors, right? So, and there's nothing wrong with making money. But the reality is, again, this was about me trying to learn how to make that inclusive. So for me, Wall Street was an incredible learning in terms of the power of finance. I mean, I was very young. I basically, you know, was, and again, along with my peers of my age, we were dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, what it showed me was also the fact that, you know, if you are actually smart about how you can structure financial products, if you can actually be smart about convincing the investors, this is something, or even in our case, and we were talking, working with companies for the mergers and acquisitions and capital raise, it really is about sort of convincing the other person that this is something that's good for them. And I think those are all the things I took away. And also, I really did take away, I would say, an incredible work ethic. You know, I am in my mid-50s. And even now, I work, you know, like 14 to 16 hours a day. So I just took away incredible work ethic that, you know what, to make something happen, you have to work hard.
Could you tell us about how you went about building this ecosystem, how you went about building a social stock exchange?
Right. So I think, let me just step back. So I think, as I cover in the book, so we created the world's first public social stock exchange, actually with the Mauritius government. So we did that. We worked with the government and we created the structure. We created the whole setup. And I think what that taught us in the process is you just can't create an exchange without actually having an ecosystem around it. And I think that learning, because again, it was, we did it, you know, for the government, for the Mauritian government, and we realized very quickly that the government was not willing to kind of put the resource behind creating an ecosystem. So basically what I said was, you know what, we'll create our own. So this is where we went in and really sort of started creating an ecosystem. And I'd say, you know, I would actually not just jump into stock exchanges. And again, this is a mistake we all make, which is sort of jumping into how and thinking there's a silver bullet somewhere, but really sort of saying, stepping back and saying, again, where is the system now? And how can we actually bring in many more stakeholders around it? So for us, creating that ecosystem meant that we actually needed to have a way. So for us, it was the IX Institute, where now to date, we had over, 9,000 people who have gone through it. Basically, where we had lawyers, accountant, researchers, academics, you know, all of them basically be able to go through this and be able to sort of educate themselves that, oh, what it actually means, you know, to actually have, make investments or raise capital, you know, with impact side to it. Oh, how do you actually do it? You know, how do you measure impact? So all of these things, we actually have courses around it. And the reason is, again, for me, it was, if we are going to create a system, I need to make sure every stakeholder there actually knew what they're getting into. They actually know what it's all about. So given that, and given that we also hand in hand did a lot of research in all these different countries, in really figuring out how the ecosystem was different in every single country, and really kind of realizing, oh, okay, you know, in this country, they don't really have as many kind of lawyers, you know, who can help with that. You know, what can we do about that? So we actually spend a lot of resources. So now, we had an ecosystem that was coming together, and really that meant that now we are ready to have a platform, an exchange where the buyers and sellers could come together. In this case, the buyers and sellers being investors and enterprises. So we actually also spend time with enterprises getting them investment ready. So I am a firm believer that there are a lot of accelerators and all that which is out there, but if they can't actually help the entities raise capital, they're just useless, okay? So for us, it really was the fact that we're going to have these enterprises, we're going to handhold them and basically be able to bring in the investors. Again, for us, our platform is, it's a private placement platform. You can, you know, it's a stock exchange and you can call it whatever you want. And it's set in Singapore, which has extremely strict financial regulations. So we only could work with accredited investors, you know, these investors who are basically, who can take the risk, basically. Their net worth is over $2 million. It doesn't matter if they actually lost money. So the government is more comfortable for us to be working with these investors. So on one hand, we had to vet the investors. On the other hand, we also had to vet the enterprises to make sure that they could actually absorb the capital, they could actually return the investment. And for us, as I said, when I started off my conversation, I think the biggest thing for us is the fact that we could actually measure the impact that was being created. So we were able to show that this foundation of impact measurement is actually correlated with obviously the financials that the company was sharing, the operational goals that the company was sharing. And it was very, very effective for us.
Could you talk about your presence in India and your association with social enterprises here?
Our platform is called Impact Partners. We have raised on Impact Partners now about 160 million plus. And again, almost one third of that in India. So we have been, you know, it's absolutely wonderful that India is now looking to create a social stock exchange. But when people from the government reached out to us, I said, you know, we're very happy to help because we actually have been doing this for 12 years. So this is a no-brainer for us. And guess what? A lot of Indian entities are raising capital from us. And of course, they're able to access not only Indian investors, but actually investors from across the globe. So we are very, very pleased that we played such a significant role in India in basically establishing, you know, the whole impact investment ecosystem, as well as bring so much investment into India and into these enterprises.
Right. Well, what are some of the enterprises from India that are listed on?
So basically we have had, say, an enterprise which was a mobile eye clinic in Assam. We had enterprise, you know, which basically was making medicine out of marigold. We had enterprises which are the e-bikes, you know, the doing delivery on the e-bikes. But what we insisted was that the bike drivers would be women. So again, they had to make that investment on that. Carve out part of it for that. We have had enterprises in India which are very much focused on waste management. So it's really across the gamut because, you know, we have raised a lot. I mean, I don't know, probably 60 million or plus. And these are not massively big investments, right? I mean, these are, you know, million or maybe a little more over several rounds. And I guess I would say one of our big success story is Kinara, you know, which obviously gives small loans to the, you know, corner stores. And literally, I personally invested in them when they were in their first round. I think it was like 16,000, and I personally invested in it. They were on our exchange. They grew, they did several rounds, and now they're in our bonds. And it's one of the, you know, large, you know, microfinance, at least, you know, mid-sized finance entities now in India. And I feel very proud that we were able to play such a significant role in its growth.
Right. So is India ready for a social stock exchange? And what's in it for the investors here? And what should they look out for?
Well, I'm actually not too sure how the exchange is being formed. So I do think that, again, as I said, we did offer to help out several times because we are doing it and they are Indian entities who are on our exchange. So the thing is, without knowing much, I can't really comment on it, you know, what they're doing and what it will be. I've been hearing about it for a while and I don't think it has launched yet, because the reality is, if you're going to put something together and if it actually doesn't work, and if it actually, when there's actually something that is working, but it doesn't work, or if it actually leaves the investors with a bad taste, I think it'll set things back a lot for India. Because I do feel that India is a thriving market for impact investing, and a lot of people played a role in making it such. And it's, you know, they're great players in the market. But I do think that, you know, sometimes when the government comes in with the right intention, if they're not doing it the right way, it may just set things back.
Right. For you personally, at various stages in your life, as you write in the book, you felt like you don't, maybe you don't know how to proceed further. You don't know what your sense of purpose is. And especially you felt let down because you didn't know how you could make the lives of women better, because that's something that was, that you were very passionate about. At this stage in your life, how do you look at the kind of impact that you've been able to create, and how do you view the change that you've
made? And you know, I purposely kind of shared all that. I shared all my vulnerabilities. I shared all my, you know, confusion in the process, because the reality is, you know, I think, you know, if someone goes up there and says, oh, I knew all the answers, and, you know, I knew exactly what I wanted to do and I did it and life was perfect, good for them. But the reality is, for most of us, that's not the case, right? Because for most of us, life is actually a journey with a lot of ups and downs, with a lot of hiccups, with a lot of hurdles, a lot of times falling down and not wanting to get up, you know? So the reality is, that is okay. You know, I wanted the book to kind of make sure it conveys the message, you know, it is okay to be confused. It's okay to be feeling like I want to give up. You know, but what will make you, that small little thing that will make you want to get up and just keep on moving forward, is the North Star. And for me, it really was about having an equitable society, you know, where everyone had a voice, everyone had a purpose, everyone had a value. So for me, that was kind of my North Star. And I do feel that, and, you know, and more so, I think with women more so than men, I think we do a lot of times have that vis-a-vis our family, you know, if we are a mother and we'll say, oh my God, no, I just have to push through for my children or whatever. But I do think it has to be beyond that, because we have so much more to give, you know, so it has to be more than just our families.
That's really well put. And, you know, before I ask you my last question, there's just a very interesting line in your book that has stayed with me, and I've been thinking about it. It's early on in the chapter called Being a Girl, where your grandmother tells you that, remember, men are like children. They don't understand the ways of the world very well. That's why we women have to take care of them and do the thinking for them. Let them scream and shout. They don't have the power. We do. So I've been thinking about this. It's like, on one hand, you say that women have the power, they wield the power, but at the same time, you put the responsibility on the woman, saying, okay, it's your responsibility to take care of the man because he doesn't know better. How do you make sense of this? And because...
So I think if you remember in the book, I do sort of put it as almost like this paradox, right? So where... And this, again, coming from my grandmother, who literally had no power, right? And I kind of show how she would be defined in her own way. And there's some, it's so funny in the States, the book is really, my God, I didn't expect it. It's really creating a big stir. And I hope it does the same in South Asia. And everyone is fixating on that story about my grandmother. And I think for, you know, her smoking the hookah. And I think, you know, I almost... When I remember when she would say this to me, because, you know, because I was very rebellious, right? And I would question the mullah, you know, I would just, I think the, it was her way to almost kind of say, when I looked at her, I would, and she would say this to me quite often. And I would think that, you know, she knows that if she says, you know what, stop doing this, I will not stop. So it was for her to kind of say, hey, listen, you know, you have more power than you think, which actually is not true. So I think I almost felt like, you know, this is how she had justified her own life, you know, and that's what I did in terms of also bringing in the motive of the Nakshikathas and women sort of, you know, stitching the life they wanted. So in some ways, you know, I think we all do that, you know, when life didn't give us what we wanted, when we couldn't make life give us what we wanted, you know, I mean, I think, let me put it that way. Maybe the best way is acceptance, and we kind of find our own way to accept. Okay. And for me, it really was, even when at an early age, when my grandmother would say it in my head, I was thinking that, yeah, right. I mean, that, you know, that's the justification you give to yourself to deal with my grandfather. But, you know, it's kind of like, you're absolutely right. I think if you think about it, and again, I'm from our from your listeners, I'm sure a lot of the women can relate to this. You know, we're always told, take care of your younger brother, you know, take care, go and make some tea for your father. He had a long day, you know, like, you know, I always joke now that, you know, I work so many hours in a day, no one's making me tea. So, you know, I'm going to make my own tea. So I think the reality is, I think, you know, we are kind of in our society, in our culture in South Asia, the women are kind of told, you know, you are the one who keep everything together, you know, and that gives you power. Well, maybe that's the Kool-Aid that we have been drinking for too long, and we need to kind of wake up to it. You know, that is actually not the case, right? It's just all packaging.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is, you know, in fact, when you go for your first interview with Morgan Stanley, you say that if I was getting ready to jump in with the sharks, I had better know how to keep my cool and use humor as my weapon. Is that more relevant for women than men, that, okay, we need to be calm in order to get to a position to be able to wield power and get what we want?
You know, I think the thing is, and I say that, but the reality is, you know, I'm not very calm all the time. Okay. And I think anyone who knows me will be like, listen, that's not her. She's not calm. I think the thing is, I know my moments when I should be calm, but I do think that probably what happens is when you are staying calm, I think it also probably the other party has a hard time kind of realizing where you stand, you know, and that's sort of a given, men or women, right? So a lot of leaders use that as a tool, right? So you will see they want to talk as much and listen and kind of say, okay. And then when someone's not talking as much or just nodding their head, that kind of throws you off, right? They're like, oh my God, they're actually agreeing. But I think the reality is, I think, you know, that again, that's not men or women, that's just good skills to have. But I do think that with, especially I think with being a woman and a woman who obviously is in finance and development, for me, my tool always was my knowledge, right? And I think the reality is for me, sort of going into meeting and actually knowing that I actually sometimes know the most in the room and what that means and how do I convey that without making others feel threatened. Because believe it or not, I do think this is one of the biggest things because, and especially again, I'll say with men from our part of the world, they do feel very threatened when they have, you know, again, I'm generalizing, I apologize, but at least in my generation, and I still face it. You will find men turning around. I mean, it's fascinating when I go home now, I kid you not, still most of my relatives don't even know what I do, okay? And they sit there and tell me about finance. Oh, I heard you do something. Well, let me tell you how finance works. I'm like, hold on, but I thought you were a doctor. No, well, I know more about finance than you do. Okay. So you know what I mean? You know, I think you know exactly what you mean because you're smiling. I'm sure in your case it's the same thing. You know, let me tell you how to write that article.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, you do not know. Okay. So so I think the reality is, you know, I think we do have that from our, you know, and I do feel that again, a big part of that also comes from the fact that in our society, you know, men are told that, you know, their words have value and our words don't. So perhaps, again, it was a society's way to keep us quiet.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Doreen. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you, Divya. I really appreciate it. And I hope many of your listeners go out there and buy the book and find their own journey through it. So I really hope, you know, they like the book.
Definitely. So listeners, Doreen's book is called The Defiant Optimist and it's on stands now. I hope you liked the episode. Thank you for listening. I am Divya Shekhar. See you next time.